Hello, I'm Manila Chan. You are tuned into Modus Operandi. It's a Southeast Asian country known for its beautiful beaches, its food popular among foodies all around the world. Thailand is the subject today after a series of failed attempts to form a coalition government. The country's parliamentary system roiled in drama, from an exiled former PM to billionaires, Western-backed newcomers. Thailand's summer 2023 elections were full of twists and turns, but now the dust has settled. So which path will Thailand trek from here? We'll discuss it. All right, let's get into the MO. It's a country popular among Westerners as a vacation spot to swim along its turquoise shores, a place that offered many familiar Western-style creature comforts, such as lavish resorts, fine dining, and things of that nature, while still tapping into the mystique of the Far East. Thailand has long been viewed as a given by much of Washington's powerful. So the last few years and administrations, the Thai have been an afterthought. In that time, the country navigated soft coup attempts, economic downturns, and the death of their king. So as the Biden administration pivots to the Pacific and turns its attention to Asia, a new uprising of young voters threatened the state's political stability. Coincidence? Well, an Asia Spring like the Arab Spring, it was not. Joining us to discuss is writer and scholar with expertise in Asian Pacific affairs. He's a researcher and activist, also a contributor to the book Capitalism on a Ventilator. KJ Ngo is here to weigh in. So KJ, summer of 2023 saw throngs of people protesting in Bangkok, as well as in these smaller towns across the country, over the parliamentary elections, which initially a young newcomer to politics, Pita Limjaroenrat, the leader of the winning Progressive Move Forward Party, that's their name, he won the prime minister's seat. It's rumored that the king of Thailand blocked his ascension, which caused outrage among voters and threatened political stability. What did you make of the wild twists and turns the last few months in Thailand's election process?
Well, you know, Thailand's electoral process has always had incredible twists and turns, and often it's followed by a coup. But in this election, 76 parties ran in order to gain 500 seats in the lower house and 250 seats in the upper house. But essentially, in order to elect a prime minister, they need to get 376 seats or votes to elect. Essentially what happened was that the Move Forward Party they had a good showing. They got 150 votes out of 500 lower house seats. The second party, Phyu Thai, got 141. And essentially, Move Forward created a coalition of 8 parties. They were able to get 312 members of parliament on their side. They thought they had enough votes, but they didn't. And this is because 250 votes, that is for a total of 750, 250 of those votes are from the upper house. And the upper house is appointed by the military. And so they didn't get enough votes, and the coalition fell apart, and the rival Phyu Party took its 141 seats, allied with various conservative parties. They created a bloc that allowed them to elect the prime minister. Now, that said, a few other points. Peter was clearly the American candidate. He was very, very U.S. aligned. He was trained at Harvard Kennedy, which, you know, we can understand as very much a national security state academy. He's thoroughly Americanized. He had a very, very Western agenda. One of the things that he was trying to do was he was trying to do away with military conscription. He wanted to demilitarize, which ran him afoul of the military and its conservative backers. And also he wanted to pass a lèse majesté rule, that is to undermine, that would have undermined the power of the monarchy. You know, it's a parliamentary monarchy. And so because of that, clearly, neither the military nor the monarchy was happy with him. And it's, you know, I think it's reasonable to assume that they put pressure on the upper house, the 250 members of the Senate, and they were clearly instrumental in blocking this coalition from getting through. So, yes, did the king interfere? You know, the monarchy and the military are closely tied. They're the conservative faction that is the real holder of power, as they are in many parliamentary systems around the world, including Australia and the UK. And so essentially what we can see is, you know, this is how plutocratic, aristocratic parliamentaries function. They have a pageant or a veneer of a democratic process, but at the end of the day, things fall back in line into the hands of those who really have power. And the US, which wanted to intervene in this election, actually found itself boxed out. The US said that it was not interfering in the election, and that's a dead signal that it was.
So the PM seat is now filled by real estate tycoon Sreta Thavisin of the populist Pheu Thai Party. That party actually came in second place in the parliamentary elections. Pheu Thai reneged on a pledge that it would not cooperate with pro-military parties who were complicit in coups in the early 2000s, it's alleged. But here we are. Thavisin purports to be a moderate and, you know, is going to focus on fixing income inequality, promote LGBTQ rights, and address other discontent among the young Thai progressives. Is this a winning strategy for this region in Asia?
You know, I'm not sure about that. You know, certainly, you know, there is a kind of a youthful wave of progressivism, which is strongly Western influenced. But as I said, you know, the military and the monarchy still have tremendous power. And as I said, it's also a country which is largely ruled by plutocratic elites who ally with the military and the monarchy. So at the end of the day, you know, these are the forces that control the government. You know, the official military related party is the United Thai Nation. They held the government previously. They took power in the coup that ousted Shinawatra, the eldest young Shinawatra, the eldest daughter of Thaksin. And now, you know, as you point out, Sreta is a former real estate developer. He was a former product manager at Procter & Gamble. And so he also has connections to the U.S., but he also has very, very strong connections with the Shinawatra dynasty. They, you know, it's their party, essentially. And so I think this kind of, you know, coalition is about as good as it gets. He talks about compassionate capitalism. He was a real estate developer who became very, very wealthy through, you know, massive real estate deals, clearly facilitated through, you know, high level contacts. And so, you know, I think at the core, it's very, very capitalist. There is a veneer of youthful progressivism that, you know, is designed to win over some of the younger generation. But I think at the end of the day, you know, it's essentially a status quo conservative and very, very close to the powers that be.
Coming up next, ASEAN countries divided on how to juggle relationships with both China and the U.S. We'll discuss it when we return with KJ No. Sit tight. The MO will be right back.
The Russian state-controlled narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez, monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays. On est en France, quoi. C'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly, all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
In 1941, with the Nazis' help, Croatian ultranationalists, the Ustashas, proclaimed the independent state of Croatia. Shortly after seizing power, they built the Jasenovac concentration camp, a place associated with the worst atrocities committed in Yugoslavia during World War II. The Ustashas used the camp system to isolate and exterminate Serbs, Roma, Jews and other non-Catholic minorities and political opponents of their fascist regime. Conditions in the Jasenovac camp were horrendous. The guards tortured, terrorized, and murdered prisoners.
They sent them in concentration camps. So most of them died. It was incredible genocide.
I look forward to talking to you all.
That technology should work for people.
A robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law.
Show your identification.
We should be very careful about artificial intelligence.
The point, obviously, is to create trust rather than fear.
I would like to take on various jobs.
I mean, with artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon.
A robot must protect its own existence or its own existence.
Welcome back to The MO. I'm Manila Chan. ASEAN, that's short for the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, is both an economic bloc as well as a political one. Now, Thailand is one of the founding members of ASEAN. Today, the members include Thailand, Cambodia, Brunei, Indonesia, Laos, Malaysia, Myanmar, and the Philippines and Singapore, and let's not forget Vietnam. So jointly, the bloc has around 660 million people and a combined gross GDP of $3.2 trillion. That's according to the Council on Foreign Relations. With the growing strength of this bloc, it's no surprise that the U.S. wanted to have a chat with them. Asia-Pacific expert and researcher KJ Ngo is back with us. Now, we should note his latest talk at space4peace.org is also available now. So KJ, many of these countries, they have in ASEAN, they have divergent priorities, even oppositional alliances in the way of foreign policy. For example, Thailand's neighbor, Laos, completed a major railway system with China and is working with Russia to expand their international airport. The Philippines, however, under their new president, Bongbong Marcos, is expanding U.S. military bases on their islands. And the Thais are now doing a visa-free travel deal with China to the dismay of the U.S. after the U.S. hosted what they called a special summit for ASEAN leaders back in 2022. Now, America is certainly not a member of ASEAN, so what do you suppose was Biden's purpose in hosting that special summit?
Yes. So, the purpose of the ASEAN summit was to pull as many ASEAN countries into the U.S. orbit as possible, because, as you know, the U.S. is encircling China. It wants to contain China and eventually escalate to kinetic war. And it needs as many ASEAN countries on its side as possible for very specific geostrategic and geopolitical reasons. The ASEAN countries essentially, surround the South China Sea, which is the key choke point that the U.S. military strategy sees as essential for choking out China. This is what they call air-sea battle. Air-sea battle involves choking off the Malacca Straits and the South China Sea, and they need the support of the ASEAN countries. They would also like to create a land base along the western line of China as well. But all of this is to say that the U.S. wants ASEAN countries to ally with it. But as you point out, the ASEAN countries have their own agenda. You know, they have many divergent priorities, but the key priority for them is to develop. And in order to develop, China is a neighbor. Your neighbor is not going away. They need to have good relations with them. And so if you look at the ASEAN countries on a spectrum, you know, the countries that are most firmly in the U.S. court would clearly be Philippines. And then we can think of the more capitalist states, Singapore, Malaysia, Brunei, which are, you know, slightly leaning towards the U.S. And then you have Indonesia, Myanmar, Thailand, Vietnam, you know, which are more in the center. They're balancing against the U.S. and China, but also Vietnam, you know, has strong party-to-party relations, and they have their 4-0 strategy, which is to say that they're strongly, I think, more at core, they're strongly aligned with China. And of course, Laos, with its recent BRI, high-speed rail, and Cambodia, which has always been a strong ally of China, is more strongly in China's court. And so I think that the U.S. is not successful in trying to create this alliance. Certainly the language that it's using is not helpful, because everybody knows that when the US comes, you get a lecture. When China comes, you get a port or a highway. It's that contrast between building and bombing. The US has bombed, you know, many of the countries in Southeast Asia, perpetrated a genocide in Indonesia. Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam were, you know, subject to genocidal wars. Thailand, was pulled into the Vietnam War. And of course, the Philippines is kind of the odd man out, the odd person out, because clearly it seems to have cast its lot with the United States. It's, you know, authorized 4 new bases, all designed to wage war against China. And this comes out of its colonial history. It was a U.S. a colony for a very, very long time. You know, its dictators were U.S. puppets. More recently, Subic Bay has been bought back up by an American company. Remember, at the height of its presence, it was larger in the country of Singapore. That's a U.S. base, which is larger than a country. That gives you a sense of how large and powerful U.S. presence was.
Yeah, in the way of U.S. lecture or Chinese development, I mean, in Laos's case, you get a $10 billion rail versus 10 years of secret bombings.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Laos had 280 million bombs dropped on it. You know, 90 million cluster bombs are still unexploded ordnance. And when the Chinese built that high-speed rail through Laos, and you can do a one-to-one correspondence between poverty in Laos and where ordnance is unexploded, because, you know, the parents work the fields and they get their arms or their limbs blown off, and then the children can't go to school and they're working in the fields and then they get blown up, etc. It's horrendous. The U.S. should remove all of those bombs and pay, you know, massive reparations. But clearly China is doing, supporting Laos. You know, they removed the bombs as they were building the high-speed rail. And that's, you know, kind of one of the most extraordinary engineering and structural engineering tasks, accomplishments of the 21st century, in my opinion.
And in Foreign Policy Magazine's June 2022 issue, they reported that Thailand was drifting towards China's influence. Now, back then, in the same article, they said the same thing about the Philippines under Duterte. And this worried Washington. Thailand's last prime minister, Chan Ocha, came to power after a failed coup attempt in 2014, reportedly backed by Washington. It looks like these power play roles in Thailand and the Philippines have now flipped on Washington in the last year. The PI under Marcos now safely under the thumb of Washington. Thailand under Thavasin now looking to expand business deals with China. If Thailand continues on this path towards improved relations with China, can we see another U.S. fomented coup there, you know, as the U.S. pivots away from Ukraine and focuses on Asia? I mean, how long can the U.S. maintain this balancing act with all these different ASEAN countries to maintain, you know, in their sphere of influence?
Well, certainly the U.S. has the design, the volition to maintain a sphere of influence. They see the ASEAN countries as very, very important. Simply all the investment that the NED put into Thailand and the support of, you know, Move Forward is clearly signals that the U.S. has very, very strong interest. Will they foment a coup there? I think that remains to be seen. I would say never. What you have to do is you have to watch who is appointed as ambassador. If you see an ambassador who is a symbolic appointment, you know that they're not serious. But there are, you know, very kind of hardcore ambassadors that you can recognize as regime change ambassadors. And they usually have a track record of instigating regime change coups elsewhere. And so I would watch that very, very carefully. And also, you know, watch any signals or statements from the State Department. Will Thailand continue to improve relations with China? Well, I think absolutely. You know, as we pointed out, you know, your neighbors, you can't move away from your neighbors. China is your neighbor from a pragmatic standpoint, from a business standpoint. And, you know, this leadership is clearly a business leadership. They need to do business with China. They need to have good relations with China. A lot of their military procurement is from China as well. So there's a security dimension to it as well. And so I think that Thailand, is stabilizing. They see what the future is. They see the future is multipolarity. They see the future is good relations with China. And I think everybody's aware that, you know, the U.S., the U.S. empire is flailing. It's, you know, riven by domestic conflicts. And it's clearly its diplomacy, even its kind of, you know, hardcore threat-based diplomacy doesn't seem to be working anymore.
Now, broadly looking at Thailand under this new coalition government that seems to be more interested in working with its immediate neighbors, what sort of, I guess we can call it new Asia, do you hope to see in the coming years? I mean, will Thailand, which is one of the region's top economies, be able to forge its own path without any external interference?
You know, that is my deep and fervent hope. You know, Thailand has long, Thailand and many other countries in Southeast Asia have long been under the sway of U.S. neo-colonial influence. Certainly Thailand after the 1997, Asian crisis, was forced to go massive restructuring. There's a large part of Thailand's economy, tourism, which is also geared towards a kind of neo-colonial relationship with the West. I would like to see, you know, some real indigenous development in education, in technology, in industry that allows the countries not only to be more self-sufficient, but self-sufficient in the sense that they are, liberating themselves from a Western colonial yoke. And that they do trade with themselves, they build their own networks and relationships, and they have good relations with China. And most of all, that they avoid being pulled into this cold and nearly hot war that the U.S. is trying to foment in the region. I think China, the BRI, and the rising Global South systems, the organization of multipolarity are really the way to go. And I'm sure that the leadership in many of these countries, many who are very, very, astute leaders, see things in the same way that I do.
KJ, no, unfortunately, we have to leave it right there. Thank you so much for your expertise. KJ, no, is an Asia Pacific specialist and contributor to the book Capitalism on a Ventilator. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of Modus Operandi, the show that digs deep into foreign policy and current affairs. I'm your host, Manila Chan. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you again next time to figure out the MO.